You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 23rd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. What a program we have for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine will be here to talk about everything. He'll talk about everything. It'll be revealed, ladies and gentlemen. Revealed. And we'll also be talking to attorney Darius Czerny. He is with the Center for Constitutional Rights and is co-counsel with the Sugar Law Center in Detroit, Michigan. They have filed a lawsuit against the emergency manager law in Michigan. This you probably heard about this law. It is stunning in what it does. He will talk to us about that. It's a jam-packed show. Forgive me. I'm a little bit sort of like flabbergasted at the moment. Sometimes I have a habit of right when I need to be doing the most amount of work, checking my Twitter feed and then just like, you know, because, you know, what I do is to prepare for this program every day is I read and read and read and read. Basically, starting from after the show, I take a break to have Myla scream and yell when it's time for her to go to bed, and then scream and yell while she's in her bed, and then scream and yell while I'm in the other room while she's in her bed. And eventually she tires herself out and goes to sleep. And then I continue to read until she wakes up again, wants to come into our bed. I'm not there yet. Nikki's asleep. Then we scream and yell. We scream and yell some more. I am now too riled up to go to sleep, so I read a little bit more. And then in the morning, I look through my Twitter feed on the subway and send myself stories to read. So one of the stories I pick up is just this post about how apparently, and this is not about Jane Hampshire, but the post is about Jane Hampshire. But my beef with this post was it simply because she owns a web ad brokerage firm. Essentially, they have people, I think, who opt into their network. I don't know all the details of it. I just basically know it from vaguely, but also from what I read in this post. And apparently, this web brokerage firm, essentially, says that they have clients who are both Democrats and Republicans. Republicans and, I assume, corporations and everybody. There isn't a blog that you can't go to that you couldn't have seen, like, one of those BP ads back in the day when they were whitewashing. I don't know who's, the left blogs, right blogs, it doesn't matter. So this guy, Dana Huell, who I think used to write for Daily Kos, I'm not sure, wrote that this was she should not be allowed on TV as a progressive because her company, that I don't know if she manages, but she owns it at the very least, or part of it, has Republican clients. And so I tweeted something this morning. I can't even find it now because it's buried under literally a sea of 50. Matt just said to me, he goes, I just checked your at Sam Cedar, which apparently you can search, right? Yeah. Is that the way you do it?
Yeah.
And he said, I have to go to the next page, 50 down, because this guy has filled up your thing. And they're saying, he's saying things like, I have some type of secret agenda. Basically said, like, look, that's the most ridiculous argument I ever made. You want to criticize somebody, criticize somebody. But to say that if somebody has a company that accepts Republican ad dollars and tells them which of the people in the network is best for them to advertise on based upon whatever the blog deals with. I mean, I presume it's stuff like if you are you're a Republican and you're part of the audit the Fed movement, go to blogs that talk about economics. If you're a Republican who is fighting, and there's not many of them, but I presume there are some, the Patriot Act, you want to definitely, I don't know, you know, go to a blog like Glenn Greenwald's, who's into civil liberties. Now, I don't know that Greenwald has his site in that network at all. I'm just using it as an example. But it is stunning. So I invited the guy. I said, look, he's like, how come you're not responding to me? And I've never responded to him 10 times. I got to do my work. I got to get prepared for the show. I said, look, feel free to call in to the program. Here's the, you know, call into the program. And then he goes, no, I'm not interested in talk radio. I listen to NPR, BBC, CBC. I never listen to talk radio. It bores me. I said, I'm not asking you to listen. There's a call in if you want to continue this. And now he's refusing to because he doesn't want to give me the benefit of all the extra downloads that would be involved in this. So today, folks, I know many of you are listening. You're going to be disappointed by hearing Matt Taibbi and disappointed by hearing this story about the lawsuit against the Michigan emergency manager law. You're going to be disappointed because I don't think this guy's going to call in.
He doesn't listen to talk radio.
Well, he also doesn't call into talk radio because he didn't want to give me the extra downloads. So, and which brings up a good point. He is under the impression that I will actually make money on these extra downloads. And you and I both know that's not the case, which is why I want to ask you now to become a member of the Majority Report. Because it's only if you become a member do I make any money. It doesn't matter how many tens of thousands of people download my free podcast. Because if you're not a member, then, you know, Sammy's papa doesn't get new shoes. Literally. We got to take a break, but think about becoming a member, please, today. And we'll be right back with Matt Taibbi. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Always a pleasure to welcome to the program Mr. Matt Taibbi, contributing editor of Rolling Stone magazine. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, Sam?
It's going pretty good. Congratulations on your new contributorship on Current last night, I noticed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm joining the ranks of the broadcast brethren now, so I'm one of you now.
I understand. Was that a new tie? Because like I say, you look extremely sharp. It looked like you bought a new tie for the occasion.
You know how much I paid for that tie?
$5?
$6.50, actually. It was in a little Korean bodega on the east side, But it worked. I think it did.
No, it was a beautiful tie. I'll tell you something. The best mileage of ties I've gotten out of is one I got for $5 right here on like 39th and 7th.
Exactly.
You got to buy it where there's low overhead. That's the key.
Right.
On the street. Off of a guy.
Right.
So let's talk about. I want to talk about the sort of the the shift on the right about wars. And then, you know, also Bachman, because those are the two, I think, most interesting elements right now of the Republican clown car field, as it were. Let's start with this, because there is, you know, this was highly predictable. And, you know, the notion that all of a sudden once conservatives were out of power, that there'd be a lot more sort of like so-called libertarians was highly predictable. But there, the 360 they have done on the idea of war is still pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's amazing. Because, you know, and I've made this point a couple of times, it's not just that they changed their mind about the policy, about the decision to go to places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. They've done a complete 360 about how we even talk about war, you know, because it used to be if you even, you know, had an objection or if you even wanted to discuss it, you know, you were instantly branded a traitor and, you know, they threw all those witch hunting tactics at you. And it was a, you know, it was a question of patriotism, whether, you know, if you decided the wrong way in the war issue. Now, all of a sudden they're all preaching, patience and prudence. And it's a complete, you know, 360, as you said.
Yeah. It's pretty stunning. I mean, you know, at the time when the run-up to the Iraq invasion was happening, obviously I was, you know, watching Jeanine in particular, because Jeanine Garofalo, as you know, was one of the few people who were allowed to go on TV to express any type of, not even an anti-war sentiment, a sentiment that, hey, maybe we should wait for these weapons inspectors to do their job in Iraq. And literally, there was an entire industry developed around mocking and hating her and labeling her, you know, some type of freak show for even having the audacity to present that idea.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. As you said, it wasn't just, you know, that there was opposition. It was just, let's wait a few months, or, you know, let's invade a little bit later after we have, you know, a complete case to take to the United Nations or something like that. You know, that idea was completely dismissed. And, you know, of course, in retrospect, the reason for that, of course, was there was an incredible need for them to get into Iraq as quickly as possible, because the ostensible justification was going to evaporate the longer they waited. So they had to rush into into Iraq. But everybody, the entire media apparatus, was complicit in allowing that to happen, and now all of a sudden they're all pretending that they weren't part of that, that's the part that I really find offensive.
You know, as you watch this, I mean, because one of the things I noticed in the Republican field, obviously Ron Paul, and you mentioned this too, Ron Paul has been thoroughly consistent throughout, at least as long as I've been aware of him on this topic. So put him aside for a second. When you look at that field on the stage in New Hampshire, you had Rick Santorum, who's still sort of embracing that neoconservative notion of, like, you know, freedom is the sweetest if you receive it through a bullet, essentially.
Right.
But Mitt Romney now was talking about getting out of Afghanistan. He was staking out a position that was not, it's not terribly different from Obama's, but that in and of itself is interesting, particularly at the beginning of the campaign. Where do you think this leads? I mean, when you start to, like, you cite Roth Dothow as an example in the New York Times as a guy who's done one of these 360s. When you start to see this, do you think they are essentially opening the door to try and make this a some type of, you know, and it's relevant because of Obama's speech last night, but at the very least, they were trying to provide some oxygen and space for this to be a Republican
issue?
Yeah,
no, absolutely. You know, I think in the same way that the Democrats in 2004, but particularly in 2006, you know, strategized a way to capture anti-war sentiment without actually being really against the war. I think what we're going to see is the same thing on the Republican side now. They recognize that there's a huge amount of confusion and discontent and angst about the kind of ancillary effects of all of these foreign adventures of ours. You know, you have, especially in poor and middle class, communities in a lot of these red states, you have a lot of people whose lives have been affected by these military deployments in a negative way. And the Republicans, I think, would love to be able to capture some of that discontent and turn it into votes in the next election. The problem is, how do they do that without seeming anti-American? I think they're just going to make this. They're going to make this an Obama thing. They're going to draw upon the Ron Paul rhetoric, talking about the expense and the unconstitutionality of these foreign adventures, and that's going to be their way of getting those votes.
It's pretty stunning, I got to say, how both parties really talk around the margins of this. I mean, we had, like you said, in 2006, the anti-war sentiment was a big part of the Democratic victory. I mean, not maybe the biggest part, and but certainly was a substantial part of it. And we still have seen no reduction in defense spending. We've seen no
right.
reduction in the amount of bases we have. I mean, it seems right, but the problem is it seems like anybody who runs for president is inhibited by actually really talking to the problem, because then they're girlies. They're girly types.
Right, yeah. You can't it's hard to run a campaign, a successful campaign, talking about reducing military spending. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. As much as I completely dislike the guy, Rand Paul he won an election having talked about reducing military spending, and I think he's still doing that as senator. Whether that actually turns into anything real is another question entirely. But for the most part, it's a taboo. It's one of those taboos we have in American politics. Being anti-war in any way, anti-military spending, it's something that's not talked about.
And we should also remember that, while we had recruitment issues 4 or 5 years ago, the upshot of the massive amount of unemployment is that we got a lot of new soldiers and Marines now.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they were doling out those gigantic bonuses, and so that was part of the positive PR back then.
Let's just shift to another feature of that debate, which was sort of the emergence of Michelle Bachmann as a credible contender for the Republican nomination. I mean, I actually think there's a 30% chance that she could end up being like vice president. Maybe a 30% chance she could end up being president at this point. Let's talk about her, because I think she is one of the most dangerous figures that is on the political scene right now. Because as much as Sarah Palin was espousing sort of maybe similar politics, she's not crazy like Sarah Palin is crazy. It's a different type of crazy.
Right. Yeah, Sarah Palin is just a goofball. She's
right.
I think if you really get if you scratch the surface of Sarah Palin and you want to see what she's all about underneath, I think this is a person who's just really, really turned on by the kind of side benefits of reality show celebrity and being famous. And, if any designs that she ever had on the White House were, I think, purely about, the adulation and the luxury that she would get by gaining that office, Michelle Bachmann is an entirely different kind of person. She is a committed, true believer, this is an extreme comparison, but kind of the Osama bin Laden school. I think she views herself as a kind of warrior princess for God, and her entire political career on one level is really about getting power so that she can you know, restore a Christian caliphate that she thinks once existed here in America. And she's deadly serious about that. And you can see that in the difference between the way she and Sarah Palin run their campaigns. And Sarah Palin was really never interested in the hard work of getting elected. She didn't pound the pavement. She didn't press the flesh as much, whereas Michelle Bachmann is just relentless. She will do the work. Everybody I talked to who ever tangled with her before says the same thing, that she, you know, that she will, you know, work round the clock to maximize her opportunities. So she, yeah, like you said, she's much more dangerous than Palin is.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Minneapolis this past week at Netroots Nation, you know, the thing I was harping on with people was this idea that, you know, the reason why Sarah Palin has no support amongst even Republicans at this point is because when you say she's crazy, that actually resonates with Republicans because they know that she doesn't have the intelligence, the drive, the interest to actually be president, but she still claims she could be. And that is, that delusion is crazy. But Michelle Bachmann is not crazy in the way that would resonate with people on the right. She's a fundamentalist. She is a religious right. extremist who is literally like the very definition of a zealot.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. She really believes that, you know, I mean, she gave a speech in 2006 where she talks about, you know, how she decided to get married. And she claims that she and a female friend from college were praying one night, and God spoke to them, and they gave them both a vision that she was going to marry this man named Marcus Bachmann. And apparently Marcus had the same vision at the same time. And so all of these three people were, you know, had this, you know, experience speaking to God. And you know, God also told her to go into postdoctorate tax law, you know, all these different things. I mean, this is a person who genuinely believes that she's communing with God on a regular basis. And, you know, it's not an act, you know, it's really what she is underneath. So it's a different kind of thing. I think Sarah Palin was playing at being a politician, whereas Michelle Bachmann is on a crusade and you know, the fact that it happens to be a Democratic election is kind of secondary to her just overall goal of fighting for God.
That mutual vision thing I like, and I wonder if who stole it from who, because, you know, Caprica 6 and Gaius Baltar and President Roslin, they all had the same vision, too, when they were looking for that Cylon baby in Battlestar Galactica.
So, I had forgotten about that.
Well, I'm actually watching it again with my wife. We're almost at the end. And so the first thing that that reminds me of is that mutual vision that they all had simultaneously. What happened to that the third woman? Does she sort of like... Does she live with them now, or what? Did they just basically say, you know?
I have no idea. She never came up again in the Bachmann Gospel. So
I wonder if you have to kill her at that point if she shares that vision. I'm not sure how it works. I don't know the details of these things. But that's, you know, that's the point. She is this fundamentalist, and I think that's what's so great. Why I enjoyed your piece so much, because I think people need to understand that this is the only way to attack this woman, essentially, is as a religious fundamentalist, because she either has to, because she's done a pretty good job of toning that down as she runs, right? I mean,
she's
adopted this whole Tea Party thing, but she's not really a Tea Partier.
No, that's I think that's secondary to her belief system. She clearly, pretty early on in her career, did latch onto this theme of an overweening government power that needed to be restrained. But really, that kind of began when she tried to found a charter school in Minnesota, and she did it. And then in the school, she tried to kind of impose all this Christian dogma on her students, and they shut her down because, you know, she was taking public funds. And that was when her crusade against state power began. It didn't have, you know, it began with her frustrated Christian ambitions is what it was. So, that's where her whole Tea Party vibe comes from, you know, because, of course, previously she was once an IRS attorney, you know, collecting money from tax deadbeats, which is kind of the opposite of what a Tea Party person would want to be. So I think she's very cannily adopted this Tea Party pose, but that's really a secondary part of her identity.
Well, we should all keep in mind that Jesus sometimes can be fickle. So you
true.
Can't always.
That's true.
All right. Well, Matt Taibbi, thank you so much for joining us. Both pieces. One is a blog post that you can check out at rollingstone.com, and the Bachman piece, which I think is a must read for people, because she is going to be a very important player, I think, in the coming months. And it's available in the upcoming issue of Rolling Stone magazine. Matt Taibbi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Talk to you soon.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have a minute or two, and then we will speak to Darius Charney, attorney for the Center for Congressional Rights, in this lawsuit against the emergency manager law in Michigan. We'll be right back. All right, folks, we're back. Last night, President Obama gave a speech which we teased yesterday with Spackerman, Spencer Ackerman from the Danger Room blog at Wired.com. And I got to be honest with you, I couldn't focus on it as much as I wanted to because my daughter was screaming. Nikki had a night out. We each get one every 3 or 4 months. And I was dealing with Mila, trying to sell her on the idea that she's got to go to sleep. It's too light out. That's the problem. At eight o'clock, it's like 4 p.m. I think yesterday was the longest day of the year. But anyways, I have had a chance to watch most of the speech, and the assessments are coming in. We knew he was talking about withdrawing 10,000 troops this year. We know that the drawdown that he's talking about, even at the end of 2014, is still not, I mean, it's significant, but it's not terribly significant. The big significance of this speech is that Obama basically came out and publicly and coming from the president, committed to peace talks with the Taliban, which is a big deal. It is moving that ball forward, because the only way we're going to get out of there, as Ackerman said, is to have some type of political resolution. Simultaneously, what people are speculating upon was that this was also a reining in of the military mission and essentially establishing bases there, which have already been established, but using those bases as basically a means in which to do more surgical strikes, more drones. Look, the goal is to get this so that war is just something that we could literally do on our iPhone, right? So that you have an app, send out some drones, kill some people, because according to President Obama's lawyers, or at least the ones that he listens to in the Office of Legal Counsel, not the ones that he doesn't listen to, that you're not engaged in a war if you're just killing people via drone. If you don't have American military personnel in a position where they could get shot, it's not war, according to them. So if we're fortunate, we will have these apps, not necessarily on your iPhone, it could be on the Droid, and you'll be able to actually just take out a lot of people with the drones. It won't be war. You won't need the War Powers Act. Won't need it. They'll have to come up with another one, like the War by App Powers Act or something. But analysts, the people I've been reading have been pointing out a really difficult sort of tension here. That when you pursue, and it's been reported that the drone program has taken out a lot of Al-Qaeda leaders and a lot of senior Taliban leaders. When you pursue this high-value target strategy, the problem is you are taking out older leaders, established leaders who have cred, who may be a little bit weary. You're taking them out, and they're being replaced by younger people looking to make a name for themselves. You do not do that, make a name as a fighter, by engaging in peace talks. So to have these two policies in play at once, the idea that we're going to try and find a political settlement with the Taliban and we're going to kill their leadership, is at odds with each other. I mean, you could say it's going to give them encouragement to sit down at the table if they know their buddies are being killed. But if you are too successful, they won't be able to sit down at the table. And the people who are vying for the power in these groups simply won't see it in their best interest to actually have a negotiated settlement. So, forever war, I think probably, I still contend that a lot of this messaging happened, at least the timing, was a function of this attempt by the Republicans to move to the left of Obama on Afghanistan. And so, you know, here it is.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd lay, herd lay.
Incidentally, I think this song is actually going to be licensed by the app that we use to kill people through drones. Come on, it's much funner if you can kill people remotely and play this song simultaneously.
A prince on the bridge of a castle,
there's a measure running around on top of that beautiful mountain. And then just... All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Darius Charney. He is an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights on this lawsuit that's been filed against the emergency manager law in Michigan. If you don't know what that law is, you will in just a moment. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. To welcome to the program, Darius Charney. He is an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is co-counsel with the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. They have filed a lawsuit against, I guess, the Governor Rick Snyder and the Michigan State Legislature with implementing. Or I guess breaching the Constitution with the passage and the implementation of this emergency manager law. Welcome to the program, Darius.
Thank you for having me.
So is that tell me exactly. Well, first off, for our listeners who may not be familiar with this, I would imagine many of them have at least a small understanding of this. But what is this law? What is it meant to do, and what does it purport to do?
Well, what it purports to do is to give the governor of Michigan, and only the governor of Michigan, the unilateral power to declare cities or school districts or towns in Michigan to be in a state of what is called financial emergency, And if, in fact, the governor makes that determination, he can then appoint an emergency manager to run all the affairs of that city's government or that school district's government or that town's government, effectively replacing city councils, elected mayors, elected school boards with a single appointed state executive official.
Now, this is pretty stunning. Now, I've heard of courts that have done this, maybe I think in Suffolk County, in New York, in extreme dire situation. But has there ever been a precedent in Michigan or elsewhere, for that matter, for a governor to have this type of unilateral authority?
No. And, I think the key is that this is not just an appointment of a person to deal with financial issues, like paying bills or, looking at the finances of the city. It's actually giving this individual the authority to pass laws, repeal laws, make decisions about zoning. I mean, things that really don't have anything to do with finances. And there's also no time limit on how long this person can be in power for. So it in theory can go on for years or longer. So it really is unprecedented in the history of Michigan or the United States.
It really is stunning. I mean, I don't know how you can reconcile this with any form of democracy. Have they actually implemented this? I mean, how many cities have they started to actually replace elected officials with their own hand chosen cronies?
It's happened now in four cities in Michigan. It's happened in Pontiac, Michigan. It's happened in a little town in the western Michigan called Benton Harbor. It's happened in the Detroit public school system. So they've gotten rid of the school board and the superintendent and appointed a manager there. And then in another small town called Ecorse, Michigan. But they're talking about doing it in Grand Rapids, Flint, and Jackson, Michigan as well. So it could expand to other places.
So what are the grounds in which the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Sugar Law Center in Detroit, what are the grounds in which you are challenging this?
Well, we're essentially challenging it on, I guess, four different grounds under the Michigan State Constitution. Several of these, I think, claims would also apply under the U.S. Constitution. The first being, classic separation of powers argument. In other words, the legislative power cannot be delegated to, the state executive branch. And that's what's happening here because the, power to pass or repeal laws is being given to a state-level executive official who's appointed by the governor. Going along with that, under the Michigan Constitution, there's a very strong tradition of local government and localities having the power to pass laws and repeal laws. And the state is not really allowed to interfere in that, except under very limited circumstances. But in this situation, they would be giving, again, a state-level official unrestricted authority to legislate at the local level.
That's considered the home rule, is that right?
Yeah, that kind of theory. And under Michigan, it's called the right to local government under the Michigan Constitution. There's
okay.
a whole article that talks about, what local governments are permitted to do, and only local governments and local electors can actually pass local laws. But so that's kind of the second argument. And the third is kind of a very basic, which I think would apply under the federal Constitution, is that the inherent right to a democratic form of government. In other words, we're entitled to elect the officials that are going to govern us. And here, that's not the case. That's being taken away from the voters of these cities because, their elected officials are being thrown out and replaced by somebody appointed by the governor. And then the last piece, which I didn't mention earlier, is that under this law, the cities that are forced to have emergency managers, in other words, the cities that are supposedly in such bad financial shape that they can't take care of their own affairs, are going to actually have to pay the salaries and all costs associated with these managers. So it seems contradictory to do that, but that's clearly an unfunded mandate, which is prohibited under, the Michigan Constitution. In other words, you're forcing them to take on this manager, but you're not providing them with the money to do it. They have to absorb all the costs themselves, and so that's also unconstitutional.
When these managers are appointed, do they ride into town like with fanfare and carried on the backs of like? I mean, this is really stunning stuff. I mean, this is like the type of stuff that you imagine they'd be riding in on horseback and with a proclamation from the king.
No, I mean, and in fact, there's been tremendous opposition in throughout the state amongst the citizens of Michigan. I mean, there have been protests in the state capitol almost every week, in Detroit, in these other cities where the managers have been appointed. There's been a huge opposition from the citizenry. I mean, this isn't just, CCR and the Sugar Law Center and then maybe some local elected officials who are angry. This is, the residents of Michigan, the voters, the people who, in whose name the government is supposed to serve. They're the ones who are really upset with this and think it's a violation of their rights.
Is yours the only suit? I mean, I would imagine that some of the municipalities would also file suit, yes?
Well, I think there's been a lawsuit brought by some of the public employee unions because, of course, what many people think is really behind this is kind of a similar phenomenon to what happened in, Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana, where it's really, the right wing going after public unions. So the unions under this emergency manager law, the emergency manager has the power to cancel collective bargaining agreements that have already been signed by, local governments. And so the unions, a lot of public unions have brought suit saying, that's clearly a violation of our, fundamental rights to contract and things like that. So that's being litigated at the same time as this. But, our case goes beyond that and says, yes, I mean, obviously the public union piece of it is a problem, but more fundamentally, I mean, this is just undemocratic and, unconstitutional to impose this kind of local form of government on, the people of Michigan.
What happens next?
Well, the state will have, about 60 days to respond to the lawsuit. The case has been assigned to a judge in Lansing, Michigan, which is the state capital. I think whatever happens, this case is going to go up through the courts to probably the Michigan Supreme Court, unless, the state agrees to repeal the law, which I'm not very optimistic about. But,
wow.
It's the judiciary that is going to have to decide whether this legislation and this, form of governance is in fact constitutional. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, Darius Charney from the Center for Constitutional Rights, we will put up a link to the Center for Constitutional Rights on our blog at majority.fm, as well as the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. We wish you good luck, and we will check in with you with updates in the coming weeks and months.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we will be in the post show. Which means that if you would like to call, you can dial 646-257-3920. That's 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or you can Skype us at Majority Live. I don't know. Maybe we'll hear from my Twitter friend. Maybe not, because he doesn't want to juice the download. If there was a way, if I could invite somebody on who could get us more members, that's a different calculation. But you can always buy your junk via our link at majority.fm to Amazon, and we get kickbacks on that. Secret kickbacks. And, of course, justcoffee.coop. The best in fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate. Honestly, I am not kidding you. Actually, we need more coffee around here. Please remind me of it.
Yes. Yes, we really do.
You got to speak up. Somebody complained about how you don't speak up.
Every time I turn my mic up, we get all the air conditioner and room noise.
Okay, well then just tap twice.
Okay.
Do you agree with what I'm saying?
JustCoffee.coop. Put the coupon code, put the word majority in the coupon code. Get 10% off. Support a great business. Support this program. This is a win-win-win-win. And if you buy tea and chocolate, it's another win-win, too. What, five wins? All right, folks. See you on the flip side. Oh, you can IM me, of course, at Majority FM. Majority FM is the IM machine. Now up, right now. Check it out. Back in just a minute.